Listen to WGN Radio's newest podcast, Behind the Badge, Illinois, hosted by David Hochberg. Behind the Badge, Illinois views current events through the eyes of Illinois law enforcement leaders. Tune in. Visit WGNradio.com/behindthebadge.
Thinking big thoughts, so you don't have to.
Well,
here's John Williams.
How about them apples? It's 109. Kim Gordon touching in the news on one of my favorite topics. We'll get to a big thought about that here in just a second. Hey, it's John Williams. We're in the Allstate Showcase Studio on Michigan Avenue all the way until 3 o'clock, then Rokon with Anna DeVlantis. That'll be a good show. We're going to do our best to get you from Elise Glink to there, and I think we're going to do pretty well. So, Kim, you did the story about the flying pigs, which were as an art installation, rise above the river in front of the word Trump, T-R-U-M-P. Each would be blocked by a giant floating pig. It would be a one-day art installation slash protest. I thought the city council was going to approve of this, or the city was going to approve of this, just given the politics of it all.
I guess it's more expensive than they thought. That's what it boils down to, it looks like.
But it's a private venture, so
maybe they couldn't raise the funds.
Well, the people from flyingpigs.com are the ones that are going to raise the $250,000 to construct the pigs, float the pigs. I wonder if the city's thinking, well, we'll have some police costs. They said the sanitation would be expensive. I think the only reason that the city gets involved with expenses is because so many people would show up. And I have real mixed feelings about this. You know, I'm no fan of the president, but I'm not sure if the city of Chicago should get into a pigging match with some artist or anybody else that wants to make fun of Donald Trump.
Well, and I guess it also, I'm re-looking at the story here, and the Department of Transportation is also saying that the balloons, they couldn't get a docking permit because they're worried about blocking traffic on the Chicago River.
Yeah.
So I guess that's also a concern.
I'm not exactly sure what that means. I saw that
too.
Well,
I mean, you know, they have boats and they have large things in the river all the time. I'm not quite sure why they couldn't just pull it up to the side and let people go around it. But
I think they could do this. I mean, you think about that. The water traffic on the Chicago River, which is all good, and I've done virtually all of these. Water taxis, tour boats,
Kayaks
and canoes.
Right.
And then personal little, like 10-person electric boats that you can rent. It's awesome. You've got ducks, and by that I mean ducks. You've just got about everything that can possibly go up and down a river. So it is busy, but we all do seem to be able to get along. Now, if you just floated some balloons up from there, that's going straight up. I think that's more of a problem for helicopters than boats. I think they're looking for a reason to not have to make a statement about it.
Probably.
Because what the city doesn't want to do is take a position on, well, we support the artist's right to protest, or we're not going to let him protest, which is in its own way a kind of statement. And you don't want to go either way. So you just stay out of it. Say, well, it's a security concern. It's a safety concern. Whatever. I don't know how you feel about it. 312-981-7200. But the city doesn't want to have anything to do with that. Actually, I'm not even sure that that's true. You think in the back of your mind, if somehow this happened, Rahm Emanuel would be okay with it. Members of the Chicago City Council would be okay with it. It would only be there for one day. Four giant floating pigs that fly as balloons from the river up and float in front of Trump Tower in front of the word Trump. So that's, you know, going to get a lot of people downtown if it happens. If it happens in the summer, good Lord, we got enough people downtown. Have you tried to walk over one of the bridges? People are all stopping and standing and visiting. It's very, very crowded. If you did that, it would remind me a little bit of when they did, in fact, do the Willenda walk across the river. Do you remember that, Kim? Wasn't it one of the flying Willendas?
I do remember that, yes.
And that was insane.
That was crazy. Cool, but had no political ramifications.
Right. If halfway across the river the Willenda moons the Trump Tower then, or gives a thumbs up, then you have a political statement.
Exactly.
But none of that happened. They were just happy to live. As I recall, by the way, in the walking of the Willenda across the river, which was some sort of record, she was tethered to, was it a she or he? The person was,
it was a he.
He was tethered to the rope, though. If he fell, he was going to be saved by the tether to the cable, I believe, which sort of took the fun out of it, if you ask me. But nobody wants to see anybody fall to their death any more than you want to see an IndyCar crash and burn. But you like to watch to see them not do that. You're always anticipating something could go wrong. It's its own kind of electricity. And if they're tethered, well, then really, what are we watching here? So anyway, back to the Trump Tower. If you were on the, if you were a person of authority, if you were king someday, would you approve or not the flying pigs over the Chicago River? And I think in the long run, it's best not to. We've already got a sign there that says real fake, and nobody seems to think that's political, real fake. There's a work of art which has randomly popped up there, and the city seems to be okay with that. So if you want to make a political statement, go there. Yesterday afternoon, after work, about 5 o'clock, the American Lung Association had a little get-together downtown. Jeannie Moss and a couple of other folks I know went over to it because WGN Radio has a real association with the American Lung Association. We're looking forward to the Lung Force activity. They've got a walk that's coming up. It'll be a great fundraiser, awareness raiser. So I was asked to MC this little hoo-ha, and it was swell. Here's just two things I learned that I wanted to impress upon you. And I think one cause is just as good as the next. But they pointed this out. The doctor that spoke, ever so briefly, said, remember that lung cancer kills more people than breast cancer or colon cancer or prostate cancer combined. I had no idea it was such a big deal. He said, every day in this country, imagine a 747 full of people. That many people die every single day from lung disease. I don't know if he said lung cancer there or disease. Think about that, though. So if we are all, so if you want to give to the people that are fighting prostate cancer or breast cancer or heart disease, whatever, that's all fine. But if you or I or companies want to get behind something that will affect the most people and do the most good, then sure, think about saving a little of your space for the folks at the American Lung Association. Really dedicated, really hardworking, really enthusiastic about what they do, really smart about it, too. So you'll hear more about that between now and, oh, say, September 24th when they have the big walk. I'm looking forward to that, and I hope you will, too. If you want to find out more, go to the website something or something something other.com. I'll get the website for you here in just a second. You know, another interesting thing is I was talking to a couple of people at that, and they are in the service of if, say, you leave a hospital and you've had surgery done on your lungs, maybe you've had a respiratory issue, whatever, and you're discharged from the hospital, there's a company that will make sure that you continue to get the best at-home care so that when you leave the hospital, maybe you've got a drainage tube, maybe you've got a scar and it needs to be cleaned, the wound or something like that. Whatever it is, there's a company that for people that have had lung ailments will make sure you do well and stay home. You don't get readmitted to the hospital. And I said, well, that's a good idea. And they said, well, it's a really smart idea because if you are this is from the Affordable Care Act. If you are discharged from a hospital and then are readmitted to the hospital for the same reason, then the doctor or the hospital suffer a 3% nick. I never thought about that. That's a way to incentivize the doctors and the hospitals to make sure they do a good job and get you well enough so that you're not readmitted. If you're readmitted, everybody has to pay more now. Probably the government, maybe the taxpayers, certainly some insurance company, maybe the patients themselves. Nobody benefits from them being readmitted. And if they do because you let them out too soon or you didn't do your job well enough, then you have to pay back 3% of whatever the charge was. I said, is that just for lung patients? They said, no, that's just the way it is. I said, I didn't know that. Say what you want about Obamacare. I just think it's an interesting sort of insight into how legislation, how policy sort of affects human behavior. That affects the hospitals, that affects the physicians, that affects their policy because they don't want to give 3% back on every paid bill. They will if you're readmitted 30 days later or within 30 days. Guys, I'll give your company name a mention in a minute, too. Thanks for that shout out. Elif says just go to lung.org. I'll bet there's a local slash after that, Elif, and I'll get you that in just a second. About the balloons flying over the river. John, I don't like Trump either, but if it costs that much money, I think you could find a better way to utilize that. $250,000 is what they're looking for. It's private funds now. Just remember that. So maybe as a donor, you might find a better way to use a quarter mil. But if they want to spend it that way, that's the cost is not my issue. John, you're talking federal waterway here, which means a whole different set of rules and laws. I guess so. You want to protest the man? Go to the White House. Trump is not in the building in downtown Chicago. Residents and consumers are. Good point. John, believe it or not, but the mayor does not want to offend the many Trump supporters. Many union workers and individuals support the president. Hey, John, count me in. I love this idea. It blends art and humanity, something Trump does not have. A few of our texts. One other recollection here on some texts that came in on yesterday's show. We interviewed the guy who I thought was a lot of fun. He was the guy that was the captain of that ship, that boat that caught the largest, the New Jersey crew catches record-breaking 900-pound shark. There was a crew, and on a fishing line, they reeled in a 926-pound Mako shark. He said that the head was the size of a garbage can. They could not get it into or onto the boat. It took them hours to finally get it through what he called the tuna door, because they used this thing to pull in giant tuna, and this thing couldn't even fit in through it. When they hang it upside down, it's the size of a small bus, and they do hang it upside down in pictures you can find at time.com and other news sites. This shark looks ferocious. It looks like out of Jaws, and there's the happy crew of four. So we interviewed the captain of the ship, and he talked a little bit about it. He said, boy, am I getting a lot of grief. I said, why? He said, well, some people think that the shark shouldn't be caught. What are you doing pulling in that magnificent creature? In fact, I broached the subject when I said, do you feel bad at all for these sharks when you pull them in or tune in? He said, no, I don't. But he's a commercial or sport fisherman. Fair enough. You know, that's not my game, but that's yours. And I told him, listen, as a person who talks on the radio for a living, I know a little bit about getting negative email or text messages. Don't read them. Just let it wash by. Do the best you can. And if you're doing your job as well as you can and it's legal, I support you. I mean, even if I don't support you, I don't hunt or fish. But if you do, that's your right. You go right ahead, fella. Make a living. Make a living. Then somebody texted in and they said, shame on you for the, you know, pulling in of these great magnificent creatures. And then somebody else said, besides, the Bible says thou shalt not kill. It doesn't say thou shalt not kill, however. It says thou shalt not kill. And it got me to thinking that when the Bible says thou shalt not kill, I'm pretty sure it means other people. You can kill a fish. Jesus was handing out fish, as I recall, at one of them big do's. Well, how do you think the fish felt about that? Steve Bertrand wondered if they died of natural causes. I don't think they did. So I do think you do get to kill fish. And other things. The text poured in like this. Hold on, turn the page. John, when you kill a bug or rodent, you give them a chance to reincarnate into a higher life form. It's not my belief system, but some of you think that. So I guess if you kill a 900-pound shark, he could come back as a senator. I don't know. But when one thing dies, there's some people that believe that you reincarnate into another life form. John, it's really hard to catch a fish that big, and it wasn't chased down by some boat. We have hunted since the beginning of humanity. We've just evolved the technique. They used the entire fish, so good for them. They really did. They cut it up and had a lot of shark steaks. John, he also said Adam and Eve, God also told Adam and Eve to take dominion over the animals of the earth. In other words, feel free to eat them. Yeah, fair enough. And then this texter wrote, John, I'm not religious, but even I know it means you can kill to eat, but not for fun. And I don't know that that's true. I don't read the Bible to say you cannot sport hunt. You can hunt to survive, but can you hunt just because you like to hunt? Can you hunt just for trophy or for fun? I don't think the Bible speaks to that. It's 1:23. All right, a few phone calls on a few different things here. Then after the 1:30 news, we'll talk to Walter Hennigan, a reporter for the LA Times, about the latest interpretation on the president's policy about transgenders serving in the military. And also Raymond Lopez, the alderman from the 15th Ward, will join us again in the 2 o'clock hour. He thinks that if your teenager, your 16-year-old, has a gun, that you are the one that should do time. By the way, the company I want to just give a plug to, a nice shout-out, because they were at the American Lung Association Lung Force kickoff yesterday afternoon was Healthcare Solutions Group. Healthcare Solutions Group. That was the company I was talking about that helps people when they are discharged from a hospital and they want to make sure that they get the best care at home. These are professionals that help provide that. So Jorge Bologno and the guys over there, thank you. It's nice to meet you and keep up the good work you guys do. Robert, this is John. What did you want to say? What can I do for you?
Yes, you were talking about the readmission penalty.
Yeah.
For hospitals and doctors. I unfortunately had not one but two circumstances over the last 3 years where that was being enacted, so to speak, to save or conserve the money. I literally was in an emergency room for well over 8 hours while my doctor, my personal physician, fought with the hospital about getting me readmitted.
Right.
Because of a prior release.
So they wanted to let you back in. You wanted to go back into the hospital, and they're like, no. 30 days isn't up yet. Keep them out.
That is exactly what it was.
Yeah.
It was like 2 or 3 days. They tried to send me home with more antibiotics when, in fact, I picked up the infection within the hospital per my doctor, and it took him somewhere around 7 to 8 hours to get me admitted to that hospital.
Boy, that's a good idea, working in exactly the opposite direction, because now it's going to be even more expensive to get you fixed.
That is correct. But when something sounds so good, if they get penalized 3% or whatever, guess who gets penalized?
Yeah,
the patient. The patient gets penalized.
Yeah.
The hospital doctor not going to be penalized.
Yeah. Boy, especially if it's on the border there, right? Like, I suppose if it was 2 days afterwards, maybe they'd say, okay, we're going to get nicked either way. Come on back in. Let's fix this thing. But if it was 28, 29 days, I'll bet they really don't want to see you.
It was within like 5 days, 6 days.
Really?
It would have been 30 days.
Oh, yeah, on the other end. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, fought me, and because I knew what was wrong. I had been there for that before.
Yeah.
And they said, oh, no, you don't have this. I said, you don't understand. I know myself. This is why I was admitted. And it was an argument. It took me, like I said, my doctor 8 or 9 hours to get me readmitted into that hospital and on antibiotics. They wanted me to take a bottle of pills and go home and come back in a week. You know, it was just ridiculous. Absolutely ridiculous.
It's fascinating and wrong. When I get to be king, Robert, we're going to fix that, okay?
All right, sounds good.
Thanks for the phone call. You sound well now. I hope you're doing okay.
Yes, I am. Doing great.
My boy, Robert, thanks for the call. Have a good day. Boy, the eighth ring of hell just has to be the bureaucracies of dealing with hospitals, insurance companies, phone companies. I still don't have cable TV. I know that that's small compared to what this guy's going through, but I still don't have live television. Live television could die because of bad care. Live television, okay, so he wins. But I know a little bit about trying to deal with bureaucracies, and I still can't watch live TV in my home. But listen, don't you worry about me. I'll be fine. Somebody came up to me the other day, and they said, you look tense. And I said, I am. You don't have TV yet. No, I don't. What? All right, we'll talk to William Hennigan, the reporter for the LA Times. You saw his story on the front page of the Chicago Tribune today. And something's actually happened since they wrote that story about the president's position on transgender serving in the military. We'll catch you up with the LA Times and Chicago Tribune reporter on the beat from the Pentagon in just a minute. Bill Hennigan's on the line, the Pentagon correspondent for the Chicago Tribune. You may have read his story on page one of the Chicago Tribune today. And so they go to press. Maybe you read it online, but you know, you come back an hour later and the story may have changed via a tweet or a response from some government agency saying that whatever the president wanted to do or whatever his comment was, you know, going to happen or not going to happen, or what's the reaction? Have you ever lived in a more fluid news cycle? In fact, let's start with that. Hey, Bill, have you ever lived in a more fluid news cycle?
I mean, every minute, I have alerts on my phone whenever the president tweets, so that should give you an idea of how
busy
the wind blows is pretty much how the news cycle goes.
I'll ask you the same question I asked one of our reporters yesterday. And by the way, thanks for joining us. I hope you're doing well.
Well, thanks for having me.
Yeah. I asked a reporter yesterday a little bit about that. Did anybody see this coming? Was this on the radar? You cover the Pentagon for the LA Times, the Chicago Tribune, et cetera. Did you know this was in the works?
No. The last we heard about this issue was at the end of June, and the Secretary of Defense, Jim Mattis, had issued a six-month delay on a decision. The decision was due July 1. So the last we knew, it was going to be delayed for 6 months for more study, so the services would have some time to study it and figure out how to implement it fully. On top of that, Secretary Mattis was on vacation for a week, so we were not expecting any decision on this or anything else until he got back.
Well, transgenders currently serve in the U.S. military, right?
That's correct. And under a plan that was rolled out a year ago, the Obama administration said, you know, transgender service members can serve openly. But the military and the services each had to be able to roll that out so that, you know, medical procedures and services for their children, things like that, also that doesn't happen overnight, right? You need to legal teams need to vet that. Other specialists need to vet that. So that was all under review to be completed July 1. But again, Secretary Mattis had pushed that off for 6 months.
I remember Major Garrett was kind of incredulous at the press conference. Were you at the same one with Sarah Huckabee Sanders, or do you not normally go to those White House press briefings?
I stick around at the Pentagon mostly, unless I'm out in the field. But no, I know exactly what you're talking about. I did watch it on the television here, and I think Major Garrett shares the feelings that many of reporters have, which is just this all seems to be seat of your pants type of policy.
Yeah.
You know, and basically that's what we're hearing from here at the Pentagon among service members. And commanders is like, you know, tweets are not policy. We need written guidance. So that's what you're starting to see here, looking to the White House what exactly do you want us to do?
Yeah, well, and by the way, the reference to Major Garrett was the CBS reporter who said, well, then what happens to current members? What's the plan of attack for them? What will their disposition be? And Sarah Sanders said, well, we're not real sure yet, or she was rather vague in her answer. Even if you are an advocate of the president's proposal, you do need a means by which to execute it. And clearly, the Pentagon said, ask the White House, and the White House said, ask the Pentagon. So it sounds like nobody's really interested in figuring out how to do this or even what it means.
And can you imagine being a trans service member who's, you know, at a guard post or, you know, a cyber warfare specialist or drone pilot or any number of the jobs that these service members perform and have their president tell them that their service is no longer welcome, especially after they, you know, may have put their hand up and said, you know, I'm trans, I'm serving openly. They basically put a target on their back, seemingly. And, you know, for the military, they're very good at having a mission and going toward that mission. But when you don't have planning that go into it, it makes it very hard for them to get after that goal.
Well, it sure does sound like the cart's before the horse here. I mean, if you were going to do that, you should have figured out how to do it and then announce it, launch it, execute it, do that. But simply to say this has to happen, now you all go figure that out. And by the way, maybe it's not legal, maybe it's not practical, maybe it's not necessary. Sure does seem to be cattywampus. And to your point about imagine a transgender person who is out and is serving in some perilous or non-position, not perilous position, but they're serving our country. Imagine how disenfranchised they must feel. Coincidentally, the president announced this on the anniversary of the integration of the armed services, so the blacks could serve next to whites. What a funny coincidence that is.
Yeah, it was very ironic to me when I saw that. I put it in the article That also shows to me that there was not a lot of thought that went into rolling this out. I mean, typically these sorts of messages are vetted through teams of people and specialists. And, having that him reverse policy of openness to serve on the same day, on that great, on that day, that momentous day, it was, as you pointed out, it was just very ironic.
How many people serve in the U.S. military? 1.3 million people?
Yeah, that's 1.3 active duty.
And, oh, really? I'm sorry, does that include people that are on reserves?
No, it does not.
Does the president's order include people in the reserves? Or, I wonder, would it include the transgender policy he's advocating?
John, honestly, your guess is as good as mine.
Don't say that.
And moreover, is as good as anybody else in this building.
Okay,
There's just not a lot of guidance on what's happening.
Okay, but here's what I'm trying to do. I'm trying to use what you said in the paper to get a handle on how dire the situation is, because the president said we need to be focused on being an overwhelming, fighting force, and we can't have any distractions, or external costs that are not committed to that. But if we have 1.3 million people in the military, active duty, you said in your article maybe 7,000 people are transgender. It's hard to know, but something like that. Is that about right?
Those numbers are really squishy. So
sure they
are. I've heard as few as 1,300 and as many as 16,000. So, if you cut it down the middle, you're left with something like 6.
Okay. And the medical costs associated with any kinds of accommodations for these people, and that's a whole range of things: hormone therapy, gender reassignment surgery, nothing at all. They got a hangnail. The medical costs associated with transgender in the military is single-digit million dollars, right? $4 or $5 million, something like that.
That's correct.
So it's a fraction of the medical expense for the military.
Yes, that's right. I mean, RAND Corporation, which is a think tank based out of Santa Monica in California, that's what they found, that the cost was largely negligible when you take a look at the entire Department of Defense budget, which, as you know, is around $700 billion.
I didn't know that, but okay, so there you go. So $750 billion, and we might save a few million dollars if we kick the queers out. That's what the president's attitude feels like. And it just begs the question, what was the motivation behind this? Why was that on his radar? Bill, what's the guess among those of you who cover the Pentagon?
Yeah, I mean, from the Pentagon, this was a done deal. I mean, this was not a debatable thing any longer. It was just, how does this actually go into action? But there's been reporting about the spending bill, next year's spending bill, and how the government is funded, which was packed with funding for various campaign pledges that the president had made in the 2016 election, and that there was hang-up by conservative Republicans in Congress about the federal government paying for treatments and procedures related to transgender service.
Did I miss that? That was a campaign pledge? President candidate Trump said if elected, we won't have transgenders, or we will not pay for reassignment surgeries if they're in the military?
No. I'm sorry. The spending budget for 2018 fiscal year has various programs in it. For instance, for the wall, there's funding for building a wall along the southern border. But that bill, with all those goodies sprinkled in there, was being held up from being passed because a contingent of conservative Republicans in Congress would not vote for it as long as there was federal spending for transgender service members getting their procedures done with federal dollars.
Okay. Wow. I mean, but that's That's a small victory for the price you may pay. I mean, good Lord, really? That's. I understand some people don't want to have that done. And I get why some people feel that way. But really, that was the linchpin that was holding things up, huh?
Well, I mean, there are a number of reasons why, if you look into this, there are a number of reasons why this came out of the president's Twitter account. It does appeal to the conservative base, certainly. There's a lot of scandal surrounding the presidency. You could take a look at any number of issues. It's hard to get inside the president's head. I don't know if we want to go there anyhow. But in terms of nailing down one reason as to why he would announce this, that the spending and getting that bill through so that he makes good on some of those campaign pledges.
Yeah, I see your point.
As good as I've heard.
Yeah, well, sure. I mean, there's a certain logic to that. I can connect those dots. It's 1:48. Bill Hennigan is on the phone. He's a Pentagon correspondent for the Chicago Tribune. You may have seen his story on page one of the Trib today or online right now. Just a couple questions and comments for you from a few of our listeners, then I'll let you run, Bill. But Cindy had an observation or a question. You're on WGN. Cindy, go ahead.
Good morning, fellas. When you were in high school, it was a very basic life, and Army is the very basic life. You're all standing in the shower, and a female naked body walks in and says, "Hi, I'm Ralph." How would you feel? Or if it was a bunch of females, and they're standing in the shower and getting cleaned up and living their Army life, and a male naked body walks in and says, "Hi, I'm Shirley." "Hello, I'm Shirley." How would you feel? And another thing, you're laughing about, oh, it would take $1 million to change their sex in operations and stuff. The Army is expensive enough. I don't want my tax money going for something like that.
Hold on a second, Cindy. I appreciate your call. What's your response to any of that, Bill?
Well, first of all, this has been a matter that's been studied by a number of outside analysis firms. RAND is one of them, and they found that there is no real drawback to having transgender service members serve together, and moreover, it's an issue. You can ask the troops themselves; they've been asked about this. There was a number of surveys that were done where the Pentagon went out and asked for feedback on this, and they didn't say that they had any problem for that. In terms of the spending, we were talking about these procedures, and I get the point that that's not something that you want to for your taxpayer dollars to go to, but Pentagon already spends several times the amount of money that would go to this on Viagra for veterans. So
wait, we pay for Viagra for veterans?
That's correct.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. I may be okay with that. I'm just consuming information here. As a practical matter, I don't know what you do with the shower issue or if that's an issue for these people. Maybe it is. But since local high schools have to resolve that, I suppose the military could too. Is that a concern for anybody that? Is that part of this issue, Bill?
Well, these are exactly what the military needed time and extra time and extra a year and then an extra 6 months to get sorted. So these are not things that are done in a day one day you're serving, and the next day you have trans members coming into your shower.
Yeah.
So this is what they needed, the time to accomplish that mission.
Does the president have the authority? I mean, is what he – and by the way, you pointed out in the article and talked to me off the air about this. What the president tweets isn't necessarily policy, even if he wants it to be. The Pentagon has said as much. But does he have the authority to institute something like this?
So – as it stands, So unlike Don't Ask, Don't Tell, which was the longstanding law that forbid gay service members from serving, it's not a law. So with Don't Ask, Don't Tell, that had to be repealed. That's not so. This does not necessitate congressional action. So yes, the short answer is yes. The president can issue a new policy, saying that the old policy, which essentially reverses the old policy, and institute this. If they start kicking members out, you know, members from the LGBTQ community, legal groups associated with that community have already threatened lawsuits.
Yeah.
Related to, you know, if these members are actually kicked out.
Kathy had a question, too, or comment. You're on WGN. Kathy, what did you want to say?
I didn't have a question. I'm just thinking how wonderful it is for most of us who are born in America, born white, don't have as many problems, and basically we had no choice in sexual our orientation because basically I remember when I was in first grade, I had a little boyfriend. He had no idea why I was in third grade. I have a friend who is gay. He also knew what choice, you know, whatever it is, that who he was more attracted to. So basically, said earlier about people, someone who had gone to Africa, I think yesterday was, and we up here have so many things. We might have a lot of things, but we take a lot for granted. Not everyone is the same, which is kind of nice. We're all different. I'm just wondering as far as the Army, how about if we pay 50% for them? We'll help them with it. But as far as I'm concerned,
you're talking about the reassignment surgery. Yeah. Is there any consideration for that? I mean, you know, the thing to me is this is not about the cost. This cannot be about the cost. If it is, then we should address paperclips before this. If this is about the money, then this has got to be the one zillionth thing on the list of things that the Pentagon should worry about. Remember the famous, what was it, $1 million toilets that they had on airplanes or something like that? I mean, it's not about the cost. It's about something else, I'll say.
Yeah, I've covered defense for 10 years, and I covered a lot of weapons programs. And there is a lot of money that's spent for a lot of silly things. And I'll also say this to underscore your point. Anybody who gets into the military for their health care has been living in a cave for the last 10 years.
I mean, really?
The VA is not known for having good service.
Well, and they're just overwhelmed and underfunded, and I don't know that they're bad people, but you're absolutely right about that. So if that's the way you want to go, you would be much better off just getting a job at Tribune Company or somebody else that has decent health care, because this is maybe not the preferred way to go about it. All right, it's in the Chicago Tribune today, and you can read it online, and we'll continue to follow the story. Bill, we appreciate your expertise and insight into this. Pentagon correspondent for the Chicago Tribune. Thanks for joining us this afternoon.
Thanks, John. It was fun.
No, it wasn't. I mean, it was interesting, but good grief. All right, it's 1:55. At 2 o'clock, we'll do the news. And the 2 o'clock hour, Scott Bauer will join us, the state correspondent based in Madison at AP, about that Foxconn thing. I'll tell you what, that's fascinating to me. Foxconn, you've heard of, but they make something that's in your pocket or in front of your fingers almost certainly right now. The contracts they have around the globe are fantastic, and much of the work they've done over the years has been done in China. Now that's going to be done in Wisconsin, which means a lot of things, and maybe it's a bit of a gamble on their part, maybe it's not, but I'm intrigued that even with $3 billion in incentives, somebody will spend $10 billion in the Midwest to have things made by Midwesterners. And if you believe the story in the paper today, it said the average pay for the 13,000 workers will be around $55,000 a year. So that's a good thing. So is it as good as it sounds? We'll talk to a business reporter about that and how you or I can get one of those jobs after 2 o'clock. And then Raymond Lopez, the alderman from the 15th, talks to us about his unique proposal of how to punish the kids who have guns, and that is get their parents in trouble. There's a group of students out in front of our showcase studio, and they all have those little plastic recorders you learned to play in grade school. What's the name of the song, David?
Woo!
What is it?
Woo!
Oh, this is Uptown Funk?
Woo!
Why do I not recognize that?
Come on, John. What's wrong with you?
I'm sorry. I do know that song, but what I also don't know is why they're doing this.
It's a little higher key than the normal one.
Yeah, let's get the, after the news, let's get the original Uptown Funk.
Yeah, there we go.
Compare the two.
Thinking big thoughts, so you don't have to. Here's John Williams.
There we go. Mm-hmm. It's 2:07. This is John. I'm in the Allstate Showcase Studio on Michigan Avenue. And you can call in or text in. We sure hope you do. That number's 312-981-7200. On the one and a two. There was a band of merry recorders, that is, people playing those little flute-like instruments walking down Michigan Avenue. I think they were involved in a university or something like that. I think I saw a K-State banner, but I don't know why they would be playing the recorder on Michigan Avenue here in Chicago, let us not be in Kansas and all. But we believe that what they were playing was Uptown Funk. Do we have the original recording? No, not the original recording. The street recording, Elif, if you can't play that first.
Okay.
Okay. All right, Elif, I've potted that down. Okay, so do you have the original? Hit it.
Don't believe me, just watch.
This one's better.
Don't believe me, just watch.
You can't help but to bop in your chair.
Oh, I know. I'm just wondering how many people in their cars right now are going like,
don't believe me, just watch. Don't believe me, just watch.
I'm doing the bobblehead.
Don't believe me, just watch.
It's 2:09. Okay, so let's talk a little bit about this Foxconn story. It's kind of interesting for a variety of reasons, but score Midwest, or did we pay too much for it? $3 billion in incentives to the electronics giant to get them to build, make a $10 billion commitment. I mean, if this comes true, hooray for our side. I think 13,000 jobs paying on average $54,000 a year, said the Chicago Tribune. We reached out to Scott Bauer. Scott joins us now on WGN Radio. And Scott, you are the State House correspondent based in Madison for AP. Is that right? Hold on a second, Scott. You're on line 7. Welcome to the show, Scott. How are you?
Hey, great. Thanks for having me.
Is that all true, what I've said so far?
Yeah, well, Foxconn committed to build a plant in southeast Wisconsin, not far from Chicago. And the state offered $3 billion in incentives, but those are tied to Foxconn meeting investment and job creation goals, and the money can be taken back if they pull those jobs or investments out of the state.
Do you all have a lot of faith in their following through on this pledge?
Well, Foxconn has a record of not doing that. In Pennsylvania, 3 or 4 years ago, they had committed to a substantial investment, and it fell through. But state leaders and the president yesterday were confident that this plant was going to happen. They're saying 3,000 jobs about 4 years, 2 or 3 years from now, and then within 6 years, up to 13,000 jobs.
What do they make? I've seen some of the things. Can you just sort of give us an overview of what they manufacture?
Yeah, the one number they put out, they're going to make LCD display screens at the plant. So screens for computers, TVs, and then even higher tech uses, maybe in driverless cars, in the healthcare industry, things like that. It would be the first plant outside of Asia that makes those type of screens.
Why would they want to come to the United States? Wouldn't it cost them more?
Yeah, there's different lines of thought on that. Foxconn says that they wanted to be closer to the North American market, closer to their, that customer base. There's also the theory that because a lot of the states they were looking at for building were all swing states in the election, that there might have been some politics involved, too, to get it, you know, to have them place a substantial investment in a state that voted for Donald Trump and that is important politically.
Important politically because the chief of staff and speaker of the House are both from Wisconsin?
Correct. So they haven't named the exact location yet, but they're looking at two sites that are within the congressional district of Paul Ryan, House Speaker, Wisconsin Congressman. The chief of staff of the president is Reince Priebus, who is from one of the places where they're looking to build the plant. And, of course, the governor grew up not far away from Paul Ryan, is close political allies with him, endorsed the president in the election. So there's a lot of Wisconsin-related influence in the White House right now.
Yeah, but it's for sure. But I haven't seen, or have I, many companies actually try and trade on that. The idea being, we're going to put it in Southeast Wisconsin. You guys had better not get kicked out of office, by the way, because we're expecting some favors down the road. And were those favors more from the federal government or actually just, while the president's taking credit for this, is this just the state of Wisconsin being the highest bidder?
Well, it's the way they describe it, there are a number of different factors. The federal government is not creating any new program or incentive for Foxconn. The state is proposing, as we talked about, $3 billion, which the legislature has to approve. But, you know, it was the state worked with the White House in trying to get them here. A number of other states were also trying to get Foxconn. And Foxconn did say yesterday that this is the first of what they're seeing as several investments in North America they hope to make. So I know other states are hoping that they get some other part of whatever they may invest in.
Do you know that $54,000 amount that I'm seeing per worker on average? Does that include insurance and benefits? Maybe they're making 39 and it all comes to 55, or would that be salary?
The governor said yesterday that that is not including benefits. We just learned minutes ago before you went on air that the beginning salary at Foxconn would be around $30,000. The $53,000 is an average. So we're still waiting on a lot of those details about what the jobs are that are going to pay that salary, what the other jobs are. There's a question about worker availability. Will there be enough people to fill the type of jobs they're looking for? You know, it's a massive project, a lot of questions, but a lot of optimism from a number of folks here in Wisconsin and nationally.
Isn't part of the issue, too, that you have to have the other support companies, that the supply chain has to be in place? I don't know much about this, but that seems to be an interesting concern. And is Wisconsin able to meet that?
Sure. I mean, that is a question. There are a number of companies that the governor talked about that Foxconn met with while they were here. They met with university tech schools to talk about the worker supply chain. Of course, building it in southeast Wisconsin puts it close to Chicago, it close to a major airport. It's close to the Great Lakes, great water supply. And there are a number of things going for that location. And I know some of the other states Foxconn was looking for to build other plants would potentially be a part of that ultimate supply chain.
Is there anybody talking about the cost per job, you know, dividing the potential job or maybe salaries derived from the incentives? And does the math come out in the favor of Wisconsin? Was that a good investment?
Yeah, I think there's a couple different lines of thought. You know, there's the one saying, look, these incentives that the state is going to pay are income tax credits that the money wouldn't otherwise be there if not for Foxconn. So it's not really a loss in that we're giving them a credit on money that they're earning or investing in the state. So there's that line of thought. The other, primarily from Democrats, is, look, you know, Foxconn doesn't have a great history in following through on its promises. What makes us think this is actually going to pan out the way they say it is? And we really need to see a lot of the details before we understand whether this is as great a deal as it's being portrayed to be.
Well, I'm ready to move to Wisconsin and get one of those $54,000 jobs. And by the way, I think plenty of people would be happy with a $30,000 job, although the difference between 30 and 54 is not insignificant. But what's your guess on this one? Is it going to happen, Scott?
You know, they are going to, they're supposed to, in about 2 hours from now, sign a memorandum of understanding to move forward. The legislature is going to be called in for a special session to consider the incentive package. It sure seems like everything is on track. And, you know, whether something happens to the economy globally or regionally or nationally that makes Foxconn change its mind,
yeah, right.
That's anybody's guess.
Sure. Or politically, too, right? I mean, do you think this is, in fact, tied to the Trump administration? The president said in the Tribune today that they would not be here were it not for him winning the election. How closely tied to the presidency is this deal?
You know, that's hard to say. I mean, the president did take a lot of credit for what happened. He did work on the deal. The state officials worked very hard on the deal. The speaker worked very hard on the deal. But, you know, if Foxconn invests $10 billion and there's a different president, you know, it would be hard for people to see why they would want to pull out at that point if they had that much on the ground.
Yeah, it's got to be more to it than just that. I mean, it sure looks to me like, did they just outbid Illinois and Pennsylvania and Ohio? I know we've talked about the sort of political coincidence here, but maybe it's just at the end of the day. I mean, even a successful president serves only 8 years, maybe four. So Trump's not going to be there forever. Paul Ryan's not going to be there forever. Was it just that Wisconsin was the most aggressive?
You know, it's hard to know what was going on behind closed doors in these negotiations. Everybody knew that Wisconsin was fighting for this, and Michigan's been very public about what they were offering and bills they had passed there. Other states that were in the running, there's very little known about what they were offering or what was going on. And these negotiations with businesses, you know, they are secret. The governor here signed a confidentiality non-disclosure agreement. So, you know, until they went public yesterday, much of what we now know was unknown. So it's hard to know how Wisconsin really stacked up with the other states.
You know, it's funny, too, because I don't know that anybody has buyer's remorse about these things, but this is ultimately what happens. So then the company comes to town, and it goes well. And so now thousands of people are making $50,000 a year, and the company is profiting, and they're making bazillions of dollars a year, in part because they don't have to pay taxes in the state. And then people go, wait a minute. I have to pay taxes. You have to pay taxes. The mom and pop shop have to pay taxes. And by the way, all these people are benefiting from tax-based things like roads and services, but the company is not contributing. They aren't paying any taxes along the way. They are profiting, and they're profiting without paying taxes. That version of that story happens a lot. I suppose they've got clear vision about that deal they're making, huh?
I mean, there was one economist I talked with before some of the details came out who was concerned about those very things and brought up the point of, you know, when these companies come in, they are it's a great employer, but they also put a lot of stress on the local communities.
Yeah.
In terms of services needed, infrastructure, and depending on some of the finer details of the deal, which we haven't seen, we don't know yet what kind of deals, what kind of tax breaks they may get locally on such things as property taxes and whatnot.
Yeah.
So that's all yet to shake out.
Hey, last thing. So if this happens, when does the plant up and running? When will there be lines for jobs?
The governor says they hope to break ground next year and have it open in 2020, which seems like a pretty aggressive timeline, but that's what they're talking about. And he is talking about, you know, hiring beginning almost immediately. Didn't specify what jobs, but there's a lot of talk about ramping up pretty quickly.
Hmm. Well, good luck to all of us. Scott Bauer, State House correspondent. And Madison at AP. And I should talk to you, Scott. Thanks for your expertise today.
Thank you.
It's 2:20. This is WGN Radio. Raymond Lopez joins us, alderman from the 15th Ward in Chicago, in the next half hour. Talks a little bit about, look, if these kids have guns, maybe instead of throwing the kids in jail or not throwing the kids in jail, let's throw the parents in jail or at least make them pay some sort of penalty. Punish the parents in addition to or rather than the kids. And McDonald's is trying something different. This is shocking. In a minute. Incidentally, a little while ago, we were talking about the transgenders serving in the military. The president doesn't think they should. Here are some of your texts. John, I heard an interview yesterday that the military spends more on Viagra versus transgender stuff. Ella found from the Business Insider publication what the Pentagon spending is on Viagra, Cialis, and transgender services. You know, the base military budget is $496 billion. So a half a trillion just to open the door. And then military personnel are another $135 billion. Aircraft-related stuff, $40 billion. The F-35 Joint Strike Fighter is $8 billion. I don't know, that must be for all those planes. But anyway, you move down from the hundreds of billions and tens of billions to Viagra, $41 million. And Cialis, $22 million. Added together, we're looking at about $64 million a year we're spending on Viagra and Cialis. I believe most of that is given to veterans who are still using Pentagon services. So $64 million for the guys who previously served, maybe for the guys that are there. Transgender services, $8 million. $8 million versus $64 million. John, each trip to Mar-a-Lago costs $3.6. I don't know what exactly it is, but you hear numbers all the time kicked around. Transgender services, 8.4. Every weekend they go to Mar-a-Lago, 3.6. John, are they going to pick apart every soldier and their lifestyle, et cetera, to determine what medical costs will or won't be covered? Hey, John, I don't want to pay for their Viagra either. Straight, gay, or trans doesn't matter to me, but I don't want to pay for anyone's fun medical services. Well, that might, I don't know, maybe that covers Viagra or Cialis. I don't know that it's fun medical services. Nobody says, oh, I know what would be fun. I'm a guy, but I'm going to get some surgery so I look like a girl because that'll be fun. I don't think that's how that goes. And if you take Cialis or Viagra, I think that the joy you will get from the effective use of those medications is so fundamental to having a full and rich life that I wouldn't deny you that any more than I would any other medicine to make you a well person. Come on. If it begins to approach what, say, the F-35 Joint Strike Force costs, then maybe you've got my attention. But right now, we've got that kind of money. Here's that McDonald's story. Did you see that in the paper the other day? I'm reading from the Chicago Sun Crimes. $1 drinks send McDonald's stock to new high. They say people come into McDonald's for the cheap drinks. And then they go, oh, you've got French fries? And so the next thing you know, most people who go for discounted drinks end up spending a lot of money on food. And so then McDonald's stock has gone up. A dollar for a drink at McDonald's is still a great deal for McDonald's. I don't know what the cost is, but I'll bet you it's around a nickel, the cost for a soda at McDonald's. In fact, at a lot of these places, just to show you how absolutely inexpensive the beverages are, when you order a drink, they just give you an empty cup and say, go get it yourself. And they know full well that you can top it off on your way out.
Which I love. I love that.
I kind of do, too, but it makes me wonder why anybody ever buys the large. Just go get the medium and go back.
Well, I have to say, I do buy the large if I'm going in and going out and not coming back.
Say that again?
If I'm going in to get a drink and I'm not sitting and eating, I get a large because that way I have it for a while.
Yeah. Although, do you feel a little ridiculous when you're walking away with one of those jumbo cups?
No, because I love a jumbo cup because I have a specific drink to ice ratio that I must have.
But you are the size of a jumbo cup. It's
amazing
to me. I know,
but I drink a lot.
Really? I don't know. I always feel like the ugly American when I'm at a, say, movie theater and I get the medium popcorn
and
they wheel it out to you
on a dollar. Well, and then they try to, you know, say, well, you can have the large for just another $1.50 extra, you know.
I'm like, I should be meeting the meal. Yeah, you can get the 100-gallon size for just another dollar. I'm like, no, I'll take the 85-gallon. That'll be good. I'm only going to have a little.
Right. And then it's gone. Then you go back and refill.
But here's the shocking thing to me. I'll just read from this AP story in the Sun Times. It says McDonald's is trying to modernize its image. Later in the article, they talk about what's really driving them right now is the dollar drinks, because then folks come in and spend more money anyway. But they want to modernize their image, too, by, quote, rolling out delivery and promising fresh beef in quarter pounders. Let's live with that sentence for a minute. McDonald's is trying to modernize its image by rolling out delivery. We'll pause right there. If you're using Lyft, I guess maybe that makes sense. McDonald's isn't going to have its own fleet of people driving French fries around town. But if you're ordering McDonald's, one of which is if you fall out of bed, you may hit a McDonald's on the way to the floor anyway. You can't get yourself to a McDonald's. And then if I'm going to have food delivered, I'm going to have something delivered besides McDonald's. I love me some McDonald's. But really, you're going to pay extra to have that food delivered? The delivery charge will be more than the food.
Very true.
And then the pledge that they're now going to promise fresh beef and quarter pounders, I'm not sure that's something to brag about.
No, I think that's scary.
We're going to promise fresh beef in, not all of them, but the quarter pounders will probably, maybe have fresh beef in the future.
And what did they have in the past?
Don't want to know. Don't want to know. All right, it's 2:29. Maybe one quick phone call here before you do the news, and then we talk to Raymond Lopez from the 15th. Hey, Pat, this is John. You're on WGN Radio. How are you?
Hey, friend. I know I'm sounding cynical, but this is very convenient because Walker now will be reelected on a promise they're going to do it, and our buddy Paul Ryan and all this stuff, and then it all falls through, and we're stuck with the anti-worker government that we have, and that includes right to work, or in my case, teachers and public service employees can't unionize basically anymore.
You know, so, I didn't ask him. Have you heard, Pat? Will that be a union shop or not?
I haven't heard, but I'm thinking, you know,
I should have asked that question. Hey, thank you for the phone call, Pat. Elif, call that reporter back. Ask him what. I know that's Wisconsin, but let's just confirm, what is the attitude about that being a union shop? I do not know the answer to that question. This is John Williams. You're listening to WGN Radio. We sure appreciate that. From the 15th Ward, Alderman Raymond Lopez joins us again on WGN Radio to talk not about pets, as he was just telling, reminding me he did last. He was here with our own Steve Dale. Alderman, welcome to the show. How are you?
Good. How are you, John?
You're a big pet lover, so you were on with Steve talking about the no-kill status in Chicago. What is the status of that now?
We're still working through it. We're trying to make sure that all of our pet advocate community partners, as well as our city, are on the same page with what we're trying to achieve, which is a no-kill city here.
Right. So if a shelter doesn't have room for the incoming pets, they would routinely euthanize them in Chicago. Is that right?
Particularly the Animal Care and Control Center. Yes. Yeah. And they are obviously, being an open shelter, inundated with pets day in and day out.
So what are they supposed to do if they've got more than they can handle?
Well, I think the main issue is the best way not to have a pet being euthanized in the shelter is to keep a pet out of the shelter. So a lot of that deals with ownership education, spay or neutering, and microchipping animals.
Let's talk a little bit about the reason we invited you here today, and that is the story that you think that maybe a good way to sort of get the attention of young people with guns in Chicago is to lay some of the penalty on their parents. Is that right?
I think it's a good way to get their parents' attention. You know, oftentimes in many of the communities I represent, which are Back of the Yards, West Englewood, Brighton Park, those are neighborhoods people have routinely seen in the news as headlines because gun crimes have been committed by youth. We're seeing more and more 12-year-olds, 13-year-olds, 14-year-olds on up are being involved in gang violence with the use of these weapons. And what I hope we can accomplish with the ordinance that Alderman Burke and I introduced is that we need to shake the cobwebs off our parents' minds and get them to start paying attention to what their children are doing, what they're bringing home into the house, and who they're hanging around with.
So what are you proposing?
So what we are proposing is that if a parent has not reasonably tried to prevent their children from purchasing weapons or reported it when they have those weapons, that they will be cited and referred to the Department of Family and Support Services for counseling and for family services so that they can be more aware of what they need to look at. The goal here isn't necessarily to lock up the parents when their kids are using these weapons or caught with these weapons. We want to break this cycle where parents are not paying attention to their children and to get them more involved in their lives, because ultimately we can't arrest our way out of gun violence, and we definitely can't use police at every intersection where guns and family intersect, but we can start telling parents that we are onto them as well, and we'll start holding them accountable. Yeah. Even if this is the first step.
What is the age of ownership of a gun? How young can you be and legally own a gun?
Legally, I believe it's 18 years of age, I think.
Okay, say it's 18. If you're under 18 then you can't legally own a gun, then a lot of these kids are under the age of 18 that are in gangs that have guns.
Correct. We're not talking about legal gun owners. We're not talking about people who've gone out of their way to get their FOID cards and all that. We're talking about 6th and 7th graders who may be holding a gun for a gang member.
Okay, but that happens, right? So
happens
if that kid has that at school or in the schoolyard or whatever, if we find that out, then maybe your hands are kind of tied what you can do with a juvenile, but you want to do, what would the punishment be for the parents?
But the problem that we have is that our parents are turning a blind eye too often to what their children are doing. you know, the signs are usually there. If they're sneaking in the house with their hand under their armpit, you know, trying to make sure they don't drop a 9mm, or if they're walking out in the summertime in a trench coat when it's 95 degrees out, you know, parents need to be aware of what their children are doing.
Do you have an instance that you are thinking of? I mean, those examples sound almost comical to me, but is there something?
I wish they were comical, but real life examples I've seen in my own ward, where I've had a 16-year-old walking down Ashland Avenue in a trench coat in order to hide an AK-47. I have examples where I have a young mother, 16 years old, who is living at home, pushing a baby stroller with a sawed-off shotgun and an MR-15 in it with her purse full of bullets and magazine clips.
No baby in there.
No
just,
baby.
She's just transporting
just,
weapons.
Just walking from house to house.
What do you
which means when they go home, somebody noticed that...
you don't have a baby. That's an awfully heavy...
Right. And too often, our parents are not willing to get engaged or are fearful of approaching their children because they're not sure what to do, but they need to step forward.
Or maybe the parents have guns themselves and they all see it as a way to survive.
Well, part of the problem is that in many neighborhoods, the gang culture is generational. Father to son, son, older brother to younger brother. We've seen this time and time again, and this is part of the cycle that we need to break. And by, if nothing else, shining the light that people are finally starting to take seriously the idea of holding parents accountable, even in this singular step, that might be able to start getting people's eyes to open up.
But community service or family services helping these families out is not the teeth I thought it would have. When I heard about this and then I saw what the penalty was, I was surprised. You're not fining them $10,000. You're not saying 60 days in jail. You're not saying much on the penalty phase.
Well, I think from the penalty phase, it could be very easy. We could have very easily have just said, you know what? Parents go to jail 6 months if your son or daughter is caught with a weapon. But that doesn't necessarily change the behavior. And in the end, that's what we need to really strive for, changing the behavior. Now, if you look at those situations where it's generational, then we might have to revisit this issue and say, look, obviously, you are not just some innocent parent not paying attention. You are perpetuating this culture of gang violence. And we may have to look at down the road how we can go after those parents and those families a little differently and more aggressively. But by and large, I think many of our families choose to just remain ignorant to what their children are doing because it's sometimes easier, or because they are working so many jobs they feel that they don't have the time to look into what their kids are doing. I will tell you that I know many families who are either single parent or two parents working double jobs who have made it a point to be a part of their children's lives. And I hope that this is the wake-up call we can give to all of Chicago and every neighborhood, that our parents need to wake up and get involved.
I think all of us. By the way, my number is 312-981-7200. You can text this line as well. What do you make of the alderman's idea? I think a lot of us are frustrated when we see kids who fail in school or are taking drugs or have weapons in there in gangs. And now we're all as a society trying to figure out how to help them. What do we do about this? And the answer, of course, is the parents should be involved. It's a failure of these parents. So I get that. But I wonder if something like this is actually going to have any impact. That is, if they're willing to be that disinterested in their kids' well-being, what's a little community service going to do to motivate them?
Well, I think the hope is that it'll get people to start coming out of the shadows. I think that as we make this more public and we continue to talk about parental involvement and engagement for what their children are doing, that they will take the first steps to start coming forward to start identifying their children and their children's behavior. Even as we started discussing this, I've had a resident who called me yesterday to tell me about their son who has issues with gangs and how can we get help? How can we get the police involved to intercede? That's what we want. I think the goal is to get parents who have been frustrated and don't know where to turn to come forward and say, look, I don't want a citation. I don't want to deal with this. I'm trying to do something. How do I do it? And to get them to come forward and work with us.
You represent Back of the Yards. You said West Englewood. We hear about those neighborhoods all too often. I wonder what the percentage of gun ownership is in those neighborhoods.
Legal or illegal?
Both. I wonder what percentage of people in those neighborhoods have firearms in their house or on their person or in their car.
I'm sure there's a sizable percentage, but I think...
Pretty high.
Probably higher than some neighborhoods, especially considering the fact that in certain communities, like Back of the Yards, for example, you can very easily get weapons, particularly weapons of war, the AK-47s, the MR-15s, almost for nothing. $300 will buy you one of those weapons on the street.
Really?
That's all it takes.
Where do you get the ammo for those then, I wonder?
That comes with the
same
dealers.
Place.
Yep. They drive out to our neighbors, come back with a trunk load of weapons and a backseat full of ammo, show up in the neighborhood and start selling it on the street. Couple that with the fact that our gang members like to rotate these weapons out amongst each other or with their gang allies. So you may have a gang in back of the yards, for example, who has a sawed-off shotgun or an AK-47. They'll use it for when they need it, put it on loan to another gang.
Oh, I see. So they've got a hit or some retaliation. So here you use the gun, and then somebody else needs it later on, and they get the gun.
Correct. So by the time we might catch someone with that weapon, they may have 16 hits on that particular weapon.
John, this texter says, it's a business. The kids are hustling for the family. In some instances, I think you'd acknowledge that's probably what's going on. John, when I was 13 years old, I wouldn't let my parents know I smoked cigarettes. There's no way I would let them know I had a gun. Hey, John, sure, parents should be responsible, but do you really think most of these parents are in a financial situation to pay a fine? You're not going to fine them, though, are you?
We're starting out with not paying fines, but actually sending them into family counseling.
Great concept, but the parents don't care. That's the problem. Do they turn a blind eye because they're bringing home money for their actions? Maybe the parents like the kids dealing in guns. Any reaction to any of these you want to?
Well, I could say for starters, the gentleman who said that he hid his cigarettes from his parents and they didn't know that he was smoking. I started smoking when I was 16, and I can tell you my parents knew I was smoking the moment I started.
Yeah.
The question is, are your parents going in your room to approach you about it? Are they going, when you come in with a pack of cigarettes in your pocket, are they tapping you on your pants saying, what do you got? Parents nowadays are not doing that with these guns that these children are bringing into their homes, and that's something that we need to address.
I'm persuaded by your first statement that we're not going to jail our way out of this problem, but I'm also frustrated that this just doesn't strike me as striking fear in the hearts of gangbanger kids. Because, oh boy, mom and dad are, now we got to go to family counseling. I mean, I'm worried for your good intentions by that. So what have I got as a solution? I don't know. I don't have a solution. You know, you don't want to be too hard. You don't want to be too soft. I don't know what the middle is. I don't know what the most effective sort of stick is to persuade these people to better parent their children. But
well, I think just starting with the conversation that parents, that we're now looking at the parents, that alone tends to get people's attention. I remember back when I was in high school in the late 90s, we had the issue with the spray paint and graffiti all throughout Chicago. It was quite rampant in the city.
Yeah.
And the moment we said that we were going to start holding parents responsible for their children, we started to see a decline. Coupled that with doing a few other things like banning spray paint, all of those things might in and of themselves might not have mattered. But once you start adding them up, They do start to have an impact on the situation.
Raymond Lopez from the 15th Ward's in our studio, the alderman. I pause here, and you want to join us too? We'll take just a couple calls. We're finishing a conversation with Alderman Raymond Lopez from the 15th Ward. He thinks that we should punish the parents whose kids have guns. Illegally, the kids have guns. If the kid has legal ownership of a gun, say he's 19 years old or something, then
he's not a kid anymore.
Yeah, then
they're off the hook.
Then they're not part of this conversation. Kurt, you're on WGN Radio. What was your question or comment? Hi.
Well, I appreciate the opportunity. I've been listening for the last 15 minutes or so, and the alderman, and correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe the alderman is suggesting that if, worst-case scenario, the parents do need counseling, that the Department of Family Services the parents be referred to them. Is that correct?
Correct.
As well as
getting a citation from the police department. So it would be on file.
Okay. And if I'm not mistaken, the Department of Family Services is run by the state of Illinois, isn't that?
No, it's our city of Chicago's.
What's your point? What's your problem, Kurt? I'm trying to figure out what you're after here.
It's the budget. The Department of Family Services, I've had some experience with it, and it's underfunded, and yet the alderman is suggesting that possibly they'd be given more work.
Yeah, I get it. That's a good point. What about that?
We're not talking about DFS. with the state, we're talking about Chicago's Department of Family and Support Services. So it's the agency that is run by the city, funded by the city, and operates at the authority of the city council.
Well, you're on the city council, so I guess you have some skin in this game. That is, you maybe are a decider. Does the city have the money and resources to further intervene in more Chicago's lives?
I don't think the question is, do we have the resources? Can we not do it? Can we afford not to do it? I don't think that's correct.
Kurt, thanks for the phone call. I appreciate your point. This is Nick. You're on the air. What do you want to say, Nick?
Yeah, I just want to say punishing the parents is not going to help. In a lot of cases, the parents are influencing the kids because they were in the gangs and their parents were in the gangs. They're actually influencing the kids to be in a gang and act like a gangbanger. Punishing the parents is not going to help.
What do you say to that?
Well, in many cases that is correct, but in other cases that is not. And in my experience, and many of your listeners know I've been on more than my fair share of crime scenes, shootings with gangbangers, not everyone's parent is pushing them into the gang culture, directly as he stated. However, by ignoring what's going on in their homes, they are abating it, so we need to start addressing that.
This texter says, what can white middle-class suburban people, concerned citizens, do about this? I appreciate that question. You know, I lived in LaGrange Park for 15 years, but I worked downtown every day, so I'd always make the commute into the city. And one way or another, I would be aware of the transition from the comfortable suburbs through the west side if I'm coming in on the Eisenhower, whatever it means, and you go, all right, I don't live there. I can avoid this problem, but I'm a citizen of the Chicago area. I should be concerned. I should be part of the solution, even though it's utterly easy if you're living in Hinsdale right now to avoid this. I wonder what they can do or should do.
You know, too often we look at this from the lens that that's somebody else's problem. It's that community over there on the south side or the west side. And to your caller's bluntness, what can a white middle-class person from
the suburbs
do, or why would they even be concerned about all of this? And as we've seen time and time again, as the amount of violence continues to increase, and it's impacting neighborhoods beyond what people would traditionally point their fingers at and say, that's their problem over there. And I think to the larger question of, it's just about parents being involved in their children's lives. As we've seen, even in those suburbs, where the heroin epidemic and opioid epidemics are at full force right now,
We
have to be aware, no matter what's going on, gun violence, drugs, what's going on in our children's bedroom, who they're hanging out with, and what they're bringing home and selling and distributing.
Nobody wants to spend any more money on anything than they have to. So I'm not sure that if we said, hey, all you folks in the comfortable suburbs, you need to be taxed more, pay more, buy into some product. I don't know that that's it. And I don't know that them getting on buses and coming into the city and doing community work is, I don't know how that works. But I totally get that frustration. I mean, if I'm sympathetic to this, and I think a lot of people listening in the suburbs of this conversation are, they sort of feel like, A, it's easy for me to avoid, and B, if I did want to get involved, I honestly don't know how. You know, so you can understand that, but you don't have a program for us to volunteer or something to do either.
No, there's no one simple, all you have to do is go apply here,
yeah,
and you'll be part of the grand solution of fighting violence in the city. Mainly because there is no grand solution to fighting violence. Violence in our city is on multiple levels. The ways to fight violence in our city is on multiple levels. And I think that you're right. Oftentimes people don't want to pay more. Even in the city, arguments happen back and forth. How much more do we have to pay? And I think the best way that we can start is by having parents pay attention to their children.
Yeah.
Start loving their children and being involved in what they do on a daily basis before they become another statistic.
So you're going to try and nudge them in that direction. Raymond Lopez from the 15th Ward. Good luck to us all. Alderman, thanks for coming into our studio.
Thank you, John. Pleasure.
257 WGN. Well, if the person that made the Jaws movies, well, Peter Benchley wrote the books, but if you were making the Jaws movies, you would know that that makes the shark the villain, then people will hate the sharks.
But who knew how popular that was going to be?
How
it
much
was
it
Peter
would villain.
Peter Benchley, who later said he was sorry he did it.
Are you serious?
The guy wrote Jaws, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Because now people
Spielberg
hate sharks.
Spielberg didn't say that. No, Spielberg said, oh my God, my first billion-dollar movie.
Here we go, on the way.
Yeah. Rokan and Anna DeVlantis just strolled into the studio, and with the Team Con here, we were just talking about yesterday's conversation about catching 1,000-pound sharks.
Mm-hmm. I mean, people know sharks have a necessary role in our ecosystem.
Well,
and we know
right? That's why I don't hunt deer, for a variety of reasons. But, I mean, if I pulled the trigger and killed the deer, I would feel terrible.
I know. We were just talking about it on the air. We saw a deer. I was out playing golf, and there was a deer on a buck that was stuck because of the rains and the river. It was stuck on the course, and we were like trying to figure out a way, you know, to get him off of there so that someone in November could shoot him. But I was, you know, it just is like I'm not a hunter type. I am a carnivore. But I just prefer to get it from the Jewels.
I know.
Or Polina Market. I don't want to think about it.
But sharks are in that category where they're so vilified. And it's just, you know, they're not all out to hunt you. There are something like 300 species of sharks. And only like a couple of them have ever been known to attack humans. And you look at them and it just feels like it looks cool to take videos of yourself doing these things with
sharks. Well, whenever I see the videos of the people that are swimming by a shark or something like that, I'm always rooting for the shark.
Mm. Well,
if you're dumb enough to get back to a shark.
I've been in the water with sharks in the Bahamas a few times.
Your Honor, I'd like to retract the dumb enough.
No. But the thing is, there's a difference between the sharks that are man-eaters. You can tell the way they move.
They move away from you.
The ones that are man-eaters and the ones that are not man-eaters. And the man-eaters, when you see them move in like a thrasher.
Mm-hmm.
So we were in a bunch of nurse sharks, and then all of a sudden a thrasher got in.
Mm-hmm.
And everyone freaked out. Like all the old hands, all the people that were there, that were around this, and people diving. And this thrasher gets in, and it's like primordial, right? It's like something from...
Cool.
Yeah, oh my gosh. But you also realize, if I don't get out of the water, this thing will want to eat me.
Yeah.
So I don't know. I don't got, you know, it's me or them. The shark is not going to have to put its kid through college, right? That's the way I look at it.
They actually abandon their kids at birth. So when they lay the eggs, in that case,
how did you know all of this sharky
stuff? I've done documentaries on sharks, and I worked with the Shedd Aquarium, and you know they are actually huge advocates of trying to spread the word about how they're the garbage disposals of the oceans, and you need them. They pick off the sick and dying fish, and you know it's just there's a lot to be learned about sharks and not be so fearful unless you're in the Bahamas swimming next to a thrasher.
I know that's a thing. That's a thing. Somebody was telling me we're talking about sharks, and they said, boy, there sure are a lot more of them these days. In California, is it?
There's just a lot more people. Great white sightings in California lately. Yeah.
But there's more people in the water and people looking for them, too.
And there's also just a great breeding area because they have a lot of stingrays that are there, and the little babies like to go and hunt the stingrays.
And idiot
off
surfers.
The coast of Santa Barbara.
You got that, too.
Guys named Cal. Hey. So what's the headline on the Rokan Anna DeWantis experience today?
Well, we got a lot going on here. We're going to stay in the state here in the first few minutes. Here, Susana Mendoza is going to join us. She's the Illinois Comptroller. She's got some thoughts. And then about the budget. And then Jeff Earle, who is now the U.S. Deputy Political Editor of Mail Online. At the end of the press conference today was Sarah
Huckabee Sanders.
I'm just going to call her Sarah Sanders from now on. Mm-hmm. There was a moment where she was like, nobody asked me anything about Russia. And on the day when there was a real headline about Russia, which was there was a guy testifying today openly in the Senate that the Russians may have been behind that dossier that got leaked.
Yeah.
And why aren't you people asking me about that? So actually, Jeff Earle from the Daily Mail Online does have details on that. So we will share what that is all about. And Mike Rogers, who has become a fairly large figure in all of this, formerly of the FBI, Chicago office of the FBI, and then he was the congressman. He was the chairman of the Select Intel Committee, right, for the House of Representatives. Now he left Congress, became a talk show host, and now he's on CNN. He will be with us to talk about all of this as well. That's in the 4 o'clock hour.
Whew, okay.
All right.
I'll be done.
All right. This is Chicago's very own. Oh, and Walt Willey will play News or Ruse. If you love your All My Hospitals or whatever show that was that he was on.
We won't ask him about Susan Lucci.
Everybody does. He will be here for News or Ruse at 6 o'clock tonight.